So I'm using a, so I forgot my usual voice recorder. I'm using my cell phone here with a new program. Hopefully it'll work. But if it doesn't, just understand that this may be a one-off. So hear it clearly. You may not have a chance to hear it again. So what is this, first of all? This is, it's called the Taisho. But what it is a particular kind of talk that the speaker doesn't prepare very much. The preparation is done by what we just did, which was three sittings. So it's a talk that's prepared for by going to the center of yourself. And hopefully, it doesn't always happen this way, hopefully it comes from the speaker's center. And it's received by the hearer from their center. So it's a very unique kind of experience. It's actually a kind of zazen, just as walking is a kind of zazen. So this is a different kind of zazen. It's a somewhat dangerous kind of zazen because the speaker must use words. Now words chop the world up into pieces. So the speaker must use these words that chop the world up into little pieces in order to describe a unitary thing, your true nature, the essence of what we all are. So there's an intrinsic paradox here, but we wrap our arms around that. It's the best we can do. So it's important not to try to figure out the talk in the ordinary way, but to have such an open, empty mind that whatever seems to resonate deep inside will stick there, will move you in some direction. So, what is this thing that we're doing? It goes by the name Zen Buddhism. I always hesitate to use the term because I feel that it is a label in a way, and that what we're actually doing can't be named. It can't even quite be described. So the minute we apply a name to it, we have also run the risk of creating a set of expectations, a set of comparisons, and an identification with something special, something different. Now, when I encountered Buddhism as a young person, I had already myself, just personally, given up on the standard religions that I had encountered in the world. Their requirement of belief, of adopting ideas that went counter to my intelligence, went counter to my reason. Therefore, these could not help me. I was one of these people who couldn't be helped in that way. I needed something, but it didn't do it for me. So I explored other things. I looked into something called existentialism. Now, existentialism is a philosophy that deals with the fact that you are. This seemed to me to be a very core issue. The fact that I was, the fact that I was plunged into a world that I didn't create. I didn't ask to be put there, but I found myself there. What was I going to do with that? What did it mean? What was the point of it? How was I going to deal with it? I think many, many young people, many teenagers and young adults, in their own way, confront these kinds of very deep questions, very critical questions. Unfortunately, and I'll put quotes around, society gives us answers that don't lead to happiness. So one day, just by, you know, I would call it chance, but nothing happens by chance. Everything is interconnected. Everything is part of a fabric of cause and effect. I didn't know this at the time. I was aware of it from maybe a scientific standpoint, but for some reason I encountered this path. Some mysterious reason. Now, there are a couple of sayings that I really love that I learned later. One is that when the student is ready, the teacher will be there. It's a deep truth in this universe. It's hard to explain. It's one of those very mysterious things. Another thing that I really love is this saying, when we most need them, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas come up through cracks in the earth. So, if you were to take anything home from this particular experience today called Zazen Khan, it would be that this is not an intellectual exercise. This is a path with heart. You must, if you are going to get anything out of it, put your whole heart into it, your whole mind and body. This place here, this Zendo, these friends, all together, we are safe to do that here, to put our whole heart in it, our whole mind, our whole body. Now, when I encountered this path, I read something about it. I read a very, very basic teaching that the Buddha started with, really, when he began, after his awakening, his deep enlightenment into the truth of himself and the universe, he began to teach, and he taught this very basic thing. He called it the Four Noble Truths. And the four truths go as follows. Life is suffering. Suffering is caused by desire. Ending desire brings about an ending of suffering. And there is a way to bring about an ending of desire and suffering. Those are the four truths, just that. And in my heart, I knew this was my path. It didn't require me to believe anything. It resonated with what I already knew deep inside. That was a problem for me. That was a difficulty. Life is suffering. What a path to make that the first noble truth. Right away, it plunges you into reality, not some magical place that you'll go to if you do X, Y, and Z after the person on a cloud with a big white beard approves of it, approves you going there. This is not present in this path. This path is about what is true, what is actual. Now, another wonderful statement of the Buddha was, do not take anything I say for gospel. Even though I said it, if it resonates with your reason and your heart, hold it. And if it doesn't, throw it out. What an incredible statement by a founder of a tradition like this. Incredible only from the ordinary belief systems that I had encountered as a young person already. So, this suffering, this truth, this truth of suffering. The Buddha said suffering comes from desire. That a little bit, I'll refine it to not just any old desire. For example, if you're cold, you desire to be warm, you put on a warm coat. If you're hungry, you make yourself something to eat. I mean, that's just a fact in our lives. That's not the cause of suffering. But the kind of desire that the Buddha was pointing at was what I have translated, taking some poetic license, into comparison-mindedness. The cause of suffering is comparison-mindedness. The habit pattern, the human condition of holding up a template of the way things ought to be in order to compare to the way things are. And that word ought is the root of that suffering, that fighting against the way things are, because they ought to be some other way. It's totally understandable. There's nothing extraordinary about that reality, that we wish things to be different than they are, oftentimes. Now, when everything seems perfect, we want to just hold it that way. We want to hang on to it, but we can't, because everything changes. Everything's temporary. So even when things seem perfect, that too can be a source of suffering, because we can't let it go. We can't put it down. We can't go with the flow. We want to stop it right there. We want to hold on to this pleasurable experience. We want to stay young. We want to feel comfortable and not get sick and not die, not have people we love die. So it's inescapable, this, what in Sanskrit is called dukkha, incompleteness, suffering, craving, this whole human condition. Now, if we were to look at this human condition, we could describe it this way. The very essence of it, and it seems quite obvious and it seems quite rational and reasonable. We see a world self-existing outside of us, a solid self-existing world. And we feel an entity inside, separate from that world, peering out through our eyes, listening through our ears, separated from everyone and everything. This entity inside that we identify with, that we give a name to, and then that we apply all sorts of characteristics to. And often those characteristics are painful for us because we have this habit pattern of comparison. So we compare ourselves to what we ought to be, how we would like to be, how we see others that we aren't, the things we lack, etc., etc. And it is this condition from which we come to this practice. How wonderful. Why would we ever come to this path of heart, this path of truth, were we not motivated by our human condition? We are so fortunate as human beings that we can feel these things, that we can get stuck in this way. This is the benevolent side of our human condition. Now, it's a beautiful description of the human condition. In a movie, The Wizard of Oz. It's just so wonderful. I remember watching it a couple of years ago and just, you know, coming from my Zen training and not having seen it in a long, long time, I just said, wow, this, whoever wrote the screenplay for this is a Zen Buddhist. But the essence of it was, you had these three characters. You had the Tin Man, who felt that he lacked a heart. All the while, when you observed his actions in this movie, he was the most feeling, kind, compassionate, caring entity. He felt he lacked a heart. And the Lion felt he lacked courage, even though He stood up to the most fearsome situations without backing down. And the scarecrow, who had this insightful understanding of the situations he found himself in, felt he lacked a brain. And poor Dorothy, caught up in the vortex of a volcano, of a tornado, striking her head and entering this strange world that she felt she couldn't return from. This world that was so confusing and stressful, and all along she was in her own bed. What a wonderful, wonderful symbolic description of this path. So, how do we wake up from these comparisons? From this sense of being alone and afraid in a world I never made? How do you do that? This particular path, this tradition, it's called Zen Buddhism, confronts you with this silver mountain. How do I do this? This mountain seems infinitely high. Its walls are very sheer. It's slippery. It's made of silver. It confronts me. How do I climb it? This path gives you crampons, an ice axe, ropes, carabiners, pitons. It gives you those tools. And then you climb the mountain yourself. No one can do it for you. How wonderful, how empowering. Why is it empowering? Because this is the one thing that only you can do for yourself. Not only do you not rely on anything outside you, but you can't rely on anything outside you. You finally come to the place. You have the maturity. You have the wisdom, even if you're very, very young. Because we've gone around many, many times. That only I can do this for myself. I want to throw myself on the mercy and power of some all-powerful entity outside me to take me there. But that just isn't the way it is. How wonderful. So, in this particular path are described these three. And I've talked about this the past couple of weeks for those of you who've come on Tuesday nights. I want to go even deeper into it now. These three dimensions of our experience. I think it's very, very helpful to look at this. Now, I talked about the sense that there's a self-existing world outside. It doesn't depend on me. When I die, it's still here. If I go to sleep, it's still happening. It's out there. It's solid. And that there's an entity inside, a person inside, an entity peering out separate from everything else. And there is a set of rules, descriptions, comparisons, value judgments that are layered on this world that I've been trained to believe in. From the time I was a child, that are so critical to my survival, that they are critical to my survival makes them all the more difficult not to see through. I have a very hard time seeing through them because they help me, because they're tools. But are they reality? Are things really absolutely right and absolutely wrong and absolutely good and absolutely bad? And all the other judgments that we layer in this world. So what this path does is it looks at those three dimensions. This dimension of being a separated entity in this clear seeing way of this path. is referred to as the Dharmakaya, the Dharmakaya, the body of truth, what you might call your true nature. You come from a place where you feel as if you are a separated entity with characteristics. And this path shows you, from this perspective of reality, of this one reality, there is Dharmakaya, this body or dimension of truth. We come from a standpoint of an existing world out there, solid. And this path talks about the Sambhogakaya, the world of form, ever shifting, ever changing, impermanent, never perfect in the way that we want it to be, but intrinsically perfect in its own way, and without any dividing lines that we have added to it. And this last world of all the things we've learned, all the rules, all the maps, all the very critical things that we must know to survive, that we teach our children, that they have to learn. And if you observe young children, you see them continually, 100% of the time in that process, first naming things, understanding their function, understanding their relationship to these things, and then relationships in general, learning to fit in, learning to make friends, learning to be liked, all of these things. You watch children and they go through this process. It's their job. We all went through this process. That's how we survived. But in this path, we call this the Nirmanakaya. It's the realm of your actions, your thinking, your planning, all of that. So we have these three realms in the human condition that present us with so much difficulty. And through this practice of mindfulness, of observation, of deep inquiry, they become, in a sense, purified into these three sides. So we already talked about this Nirmanakaya side, this side of the map that we've all learned to make, that enables us to navigate smoothly through the world, that enables us to get tasks done, to plan for the future, to train ourselves in a career, all of these things. And how it sticks to this world of form, the Sambhogakaya, this raw world of sights, sounds, smells, taste, touch, thoughts, and emotions, this raw world. It gets applied to them. Things now have a name. They have a value. Then I begin to want some of these things and try to hold on to them, and dislike other things and try to make them go away, or ignore other things that I can't deal with, so I just try to blot them out. And sometimes that takes the form of escapism or substance abuse or whatever form it might take in the human condition. And this final thing here, this thing that I want to go more today, is this Dharmakaya side. The aspect of this, the dimension of this reality that is most difficult to express, most difficult to talk about, most difficult to enter. When we try to talk about it, we almost have to resort to poetry, because plain talking doesn't quite get us there. So let me recapitulate what we've already gone over in the past couple of weeks. When we do our zazen, for example, counting the breath, we begin to enter this Sambhogakaya, this world of actual experience. We go underneath this realm that we've layered on top of it, which is very useful to us, but in this place here, in this zendo, blocks us, does not help us. This world of Nirmanakaya, the descriptions, the comparisons, the valences, the importances, the lack of importance, and all the things we apply to this raw world of experience. In our zazen, we come to this world of experience. One. Two. Three. You notice we don't say love, truth, happiness. That's not what we're saying. That's the Nirmanakaya. We come into the raw world. One is just one. Two is just two. Walking is just walking. So for example, when we do our kinhin, which I taught some new folks today, and I didn't get into this part of it, we just walk. So kinhin is done by walking is just walking. You become one with the walking. This is the critical task at this stage of zazen, is to enter your experience and let the layer lying on top of it, the Nirmanakaya, shrivel up, fall away, because we don't feed it. We're not looking at it. We're not paying attention. We're not running the tape loops. But the tape loops run. Thoughts come in. How do we deal with that? Immediately the mind starts to want something else, think about something that happened, remember something, reach for something coming down the road. All these things are operating because the brain does not go to sleep in zazen. If anything, we become hyper aware of this. So during our ordinary life, these tape loops and these thoughts, this Nirmanakaya, is going on to a large degree unconsciously. And when we do zazen and we enter this very centered, alert, plunging into our actual experience, what was unconscious becomes conscious. It almost seems at first that your mind is going crazy. The thoughts are getting way worse because you're becoming aware of this constant stream of thinking, this Nirmanakaya, laying on your actual experience. So what we do in our zazen is we see it. We watch it. We let it float through. We don't get involved with it. We don't fight it. We don't struggle with it. We don't try to figure it out. This is not psychotherapy. There's a definite role for psychotherapy, but not here in the Zendo. Here in the Zendo, we see these habit patterns. We just see them just like we smell incense coming from the incense burner. Just like we hear sounds in the street. It's exactly the same. Now what has happened? We've gone from being caught in this superficial layer called Nirmanakaya, the world of comparisons, activity, planning, very, very important world. It's the human realm. We've let it now transform. Remember, these are dimensions. It's all one thing. This thing of important meanings transforms into the Sambhogakaya, actual experience. A thought is just a thought. I don't have to figure it out. I don't have to fight it. I don't have to analyze it. How do I do that? Because I have a focal point, and the focal point has no meaning. The focal point just is. It's just my breath, or it's just, if you're working on a koan, just mu, just hu, or in shikantaza, just this actual moment. I focus on that. I hold to that. And now I can allow what used to be meaning to float through as just one more sensation. Now, in this path, we don't talk about five senses, we talk about six senses. We have the sense of sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch, those five. And we have thought. That's another sense. It's felt. It's experienced. And all of these senses exist in the Sambhogakaya, the world of thought that comes innocently. The world that when you allow this Nirmanakaya sticky map to just fall away in your zazen is a glistening realm. It becomes purified. It becomes just what it is. This is the realm from which this 27-year-old Japanese woman, Yaiko Iwasaki, very famous woman in Zen Buddhist circles back in the early 1900s. seems so long ago to say the 20th century. She had TB. She was on her deathbed. But she was, and she was a daughter of a very, they actually were the, I believe, they were the family that owned Mitsubishi, which was a conglomerate of very big industrial company in Japan. So she was actually the daughter of what nowadays we would call billionaires. Somehow, the need was there in her, and Buddhas and Bodhisattvas came up through cracks in the earth. She was not satisfied by being the daughter of billionaires. There was something she had to find out. And now she had TB before they could treat TB and was on her deathbed. So she did Zazen lying flat, couldn't sit up. This broken body, this life she knew was going to end early. A student of a great Zen master, Harada Roshi, who is actually our, you might say, great grandfather in the Dharma lineage. Harada Roshi's student, who became Roshi Yazatani, was the teacher of Philip Kaplow, who was the teacher of Richard Clark, and also my first teacher. So you can see how this is all connected. So the student of Harada Roshi was Yaiko Osaki. She had a profound awakening. Matter of fact, a series of deepening awakenings to her true nature while lying on her back dying of TB, not knowing that 2 weeks later she would die. And in the midst of these awakenings, she wrote a letter to Harada Roshi, who lived at a distance, and said the following words. And this, again, is pointing to this pure realm of the Sambhogakaya, when we've allowed all our comparisons to drop away. She said, "What a relief to discover that just as I am perfect." She did not say, "What a relief that through this practice I've made myself perfect." Very important to get that point. The Sambhogakaya, meaning your life, is originally perfect, intrinsically perfect. You don't need to make it perfect. You don't need to change yourself. You need to become yourself, your true self. Your true self is already perfect. This is the core of this practice. How is it perfect? Perfection means what? Perfection is incomparable. Perfection is inevitable. If it's inevitable and incomparable, then it's perfect. It's absolute. And that's exactly what this Sambhogakaya is. This world that we can see, feel, hear, taste, touch, think and feel. This world, the actual world, had to be exactly this way in this moment. It is the outcome of causes and conditions, extending throughout time and throughout space. As physicists say, we are in a fabric of space-time. This is one unitary fabric. Anything that happens anywhere in that fabric affects everything else in the fabric. So that everything is co-related. Everything creates everything else. All the way back to the very beginning, to what physicists call the singularity, when everything was one thing. When that singularity expanded, it expanded according to natural law. Everything is cause and effect. So it ended up just like this right here, now, in this moment in time, in this point in space-time. If it could have been as Richard Clark, our dear departed teacher now, always said, if it could have been one iota different, that's how it would have been. But this had the most going for it, so it had to be. If it had to be, then I don't need to apply any judgments to it. I don't need to oppose it. I don't need to hold on to it. I don't need to change it. I don't need to manipulate it. In this moment, in this zendo, in my deep zazen, I can let it be. Meaning I can put it down. I can let it drop. It takes care of itself. Now I'm free. I'm free to be exactly what I am. As Yaiko Iwasaki said, what a relief to discover that just as I am, my whole self, not this split off little thing that I identify with oftentimes, my whole self, my whole fabric of space-time, what a relief to discover that my whole fabric of space-time was intrinsically, always, from the very start, perfect. So, a very famous Zen master in this tradition called Dogen, he lived in the 1200s. He was a young man. He did deep zazen practice in a zendo just like this. And his teacher one day was walking through the zendo while everyone in the zendo was doing zazen. And he said one thing. And Dogen had a profound awakening. He said these words. He said, let drop body and mind. Let drop body and mind. How can we do that? What does it mean? What is body and mind? Body and mind is this whole thing. Your body is this whole body. Your mind is everything that is, was, will be. Your whole body and mind. Let it drop. What does that mean? It means that since I'm already perfect, I, meaning the whole thing, this Sambhogakaya, this vast realm of cause and effect, extending throughout all time and all space, since it's already perfect, I don't have to change it. I don't have to manipulate it. I don't have to fight it. I don't have to cling to it. It's unnecessary. I can let drop body and mind. And Dogen came to a deep awakening. Because when you can let it drop, you can see something about it that you didn't notice before. Because you were too busy fighting it, struggling with it, trying to manipulate it, trying to change it. What is it that you notice? You notice what I described before as Dharmakaya. This is the steepest silver mountain of Zen training. This Dharmakaya. What is it? I'll read a description of it. So, this is actually a koan. Just for the benefit of those who may not know all the terminology, koan, K-O-A-N, koan, is a teaching tool. And what it is a story about something that happened. It's maybe, perhaps, a short, brief dialogue between a student and teacher. But the Zen student will take this koan and in their deep zazen, when you're ready to do this, after you've done, you know, fairly intense, long breath practice to develop that laser beam mind, to develop this dispassion towards your thinking, so you can let the Nirmanakaya fall away. You can enter into the actual perfection of this Sambhogakaya exactly as it appears. Walking is just walking, eating is just eating, sitting is just sitting, one is just one, two is just two. Then you're ready to pierce through it. Go underneath the surface to this Dharmakaya level, this Dharmakaya dimension. So, here's a koan for you. A monk asks Kasan Osho, what is the Dharmakaya? The Dharmakaya is without form, Kasan replied. What is without form? Remember what Dogen's teacher said in the Zendo. He said, let drop body and mind. As Richard Clark said in a Futatio that I heard, that was just such a wonderful description of the attitude of mind of Zazen. He said, become the 10,000-year-old man or woman. You've been on this earth. You've gone around for 10,000 years. You've been there, done that. You don't need to keep doing it. You can let it drop. This whole world of form, it's wonderful, it's perfect, it's just. It's a part of your whole body. You don't have to manipulate it. You don't have to fight it. You don't have to resist it. You can, for lack of a better word, embrace it. Now, what do I mean by embrace it? I don't mean that you hold on to it. I don't even mean that you like it. I mean that you allow it. You allow this world exactly as it is to be in the sunshine of your awareness. And that is called Zazen. That's what Zazen is. But Zazen goes even deeper than that, even further, to this, the Dharmakaya is without form. What is that? What is that? Now, when I was a young person, after I'd encountered this path, I, in college, took a course on, several courses actually, on comparative religion and different philosophies, including Oriental philosophies. One of the things I read was a book by Paul Tillich. He was in the early to mid 20th century, he was a very famous theological philosopher. He came from a school called Christian existentialism. But there was one thing I read in this book, I think it might have been The Courage to Be, but I don't remember the exact name of the book, and it might have been just a description of something he wrote. But he said this, he said, of all the questions I could ever ask myself, the most profound, the most puzzling, the deepest, most overpowering question is, why is there something rather than nothing at all? And that struck me, because I had asked myself that question, myself. Sometimes I would just sit and ponder that for a long time. Why is there anything rather than nothing at all, without even anything to know that there's nothing? This now is the problem of human existence. Here we are. We're thrown here. As Martin Heidegger, a phenomenology philosopher, very, very famous, he described this state of being thrown. He called it thrownness. That one of the conditions of the human being is they're thrown here. Not by choice. Here I am. I find myself here. Why is there something rather than nothing at all? Now, two things to say about this question. One is this path has a very unique view of the word why. It doesn't usually ask why, because the only answer to why, the only valid, true, deep answer to why is because. Anything else is just more whys all the way down. Turtles all the way down. You never get to the bottom. Well, you ever be with a young kid and they go, why this, why that, why that, why that? Because. Now, why is still important? Because why pierces through this Sambhogakaya? Why is this question that puts you into this state of inquiry? And this is how you uncover this Dharmakaya. The Dharmakaya is without form. I've let drop body and mind. What is left? What is left when I've dropped body and mind? The particularities of it. Now I'm left with what? It's fact. The fact of the world. This is what Paul Tillich was looking at, was contemplating deeply. He didn't say, why is the sky blue? You didn't say, why is water wet? He said, why is there anything? He was looking at the fact of the world. So in our deep zazen, we do that. We look at the fact of the world. By looking at the fact of each experience, it enables us to let drop body and mind, to leave the nirmanakaya world of comparisons far behind, to enter a state of alert immensity, something called no color, no form, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch. This world of what in Zen is called emptiness. So this is the avenue in there. Now, it's dangerous, dangerous territory, because you can become attached to that emptiness and see this Sambhogakaya as unimportant, is in the way. I don't want to deal with this world of suffering. I want to just go to this space of emptiness, which we can enter, which all of you will enter in your zazen from time to time. This state of what we call samadhi or dhyana, this deep space where time seems to stop, where the body and mind drop away, where you are in the essence of what you are and you can't describe it. It has no particular form. It has no particular color. It has no particular sound. But, very, very important. I'll read you another koan from this book. This is a section in this book where they are dealing with koan that are around the question of this dharmakaya, this truth aspect, what we would call our deepest true nature. Here's another description of it. So remember the first one. Monk asked Kasan Osho, what is the dharmakaya? He said, the dharmakaya is without form, pointing a direction. How do I get there? How do I climb the silver mountain? Let drop body and mind. Flip over this Sambhogakaya. See its fact. What is that? What is the substance of it? This is the penetrating zazen that each of us here eventually has to learn. So that when you sit down in zazen, within 1 minute you're there, you've entered it. Now, here's the next koan, right after this one. A monk once said to Daryo Osho, the physical body decomposes. All right, so he's pointing now at this Sambhogakaya, this world of form, that everything's changing, nothing stays the same. So the physical body decomposes. What is the indestructible dharmakaya? He wants to know, what is this? I need to know this truth. Daryo Osho answers with this verse. Blooming mountain flowers are like golden brocade. Brimming mountain waters are blue as indigo. The dharmakaya is not separate from this world. It is this world. Everything as it is. Just as I am perfect. I am perfectly manifesting this moment. I am. As God said to Moses on Mount Sinai, Moses said, what is your name? And God said, I am that I am. That is the core of this truth. I am that I am. So in our zazen, if we can, let go of this nirmanakaya. Let go of that state of the lion wanting, looking for courage, feeling that he doesn't have it. Dorothy, feeling she's lost, not in home when she's in her own bed. If we can let that go and enter this Sambhogakaya, exactly as it is, and then let it drop, meaning let drop any manipulation of it. Embrace it. Allow it its moment in the sunshine of your awareness. The very next thing that you will realize is that this Sambhogakaya, this world of form, of sound, color, taste, touch, smell, is awareness, is your awareness. Then it is one world, and that is called awakening. So I hope I didn't say too much today. But just to point a direction, just to show you the breadth, the depth of this practice, it goes way further than just focusing on a focal point. It goes way further than that. All right, so we'll end there today.